Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. And today we have a very special guest. He's the author of this book that I just read, The Art of the Turnaround, a comprehensive 10-step guide. And this book, I recommend it to all business owners, especially ones that are having a little trouble. But anyway, we will get into that. For now, I'm going to introduce Mike Dunlop. He is an author, an entrepreneur, a teacher, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an immigrant to the United States, a legal immigrant to the United States. So welcome, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. So, all right. Whew. Oh, I forgot the top of the book. It says, How to Bring Enjoyment and Profitability Back to Your Company. And this book, you know, I always think before I start it, like, oh, can I just skim through this, right, and get to the end so I could say I read it? But no, this one you cannot skim. Every sentence is a nugget. It's full of them. And I just want to know, first of all, how did you write this? It's so logical, but yet we don't know that. And I think, you know, when business owners or people get into their own little lives, they don't have that external view, which, you know, you just put all, I've got my hands going, but you can't see it. You know, you just put all the pieces together that are needed. And, you know, you've got the financial piece, you've got the empathy piece, you have the people piece, the all the players, creating a new environment, a new culture, painting. I mean, all the different stuff. Like, did you always know that, or did it come together through your 40 years? I guess that's my very long question.
Well, it really started when I did my first turnaround. And I did my first turnaround, I was 27. And I was put in charge of a fairly large retail chain in Seattle. I was involved in the computer business beforehand, and I started in the computer business in it was 1967. So I've been in the computer business for many, many years, and I was installing a computer in a company as part of a consulting firm that I'd started when I first came to America. And I was looking at their financials as I was putting them onto the computer, and I saw there was trouble in Dodge City. So being 27 and being very confident, I went to the owner and said, I'm worried about getting paid. It looks like you're in real trouble. And he said, yes, we are, and I have an important meeting with the bank on Monday. This was on a Friday night. And he said, I have no idea what to do. They're probably going to pull our credit line. We're probably going to have to shut the company down. And I said, well, I've been around the company for about a month, and I could come up with 30 things that you could do to improve your company. So he said, could you put them together as a business plan? And I said, yes, happy to. So over the weekend, I put it together, delivered it to him. And then on the Monday morning, I got a call from him saying, come down to the bank immediately. So off I pedaled down to the bank. This was very large bank, CFirst, which was at about 70% of the business in the Seattle Northwest area. It's a very big bank. And this wonderful banker, wonderful New York Jewish banker, said, Mike, he didn't put this together. You put it together. He's never put anything like this together. Can you help him? Would you be willing to go in and help him? And I said, absolutely. And so he said to the owner, would you accept Mike's help? And the owner said, absolutely. Well, I think a long story short, we made the company profitable in 3 months. and started paying down the bank debt. And then I got a call from my wonderful mentor, Dave Friedberg, who said, Mike, we've got a closet full of these badly performing loans. Would you be interested in working full-time for the bank as an independent consultant? But we can give you as much business as you could possibly take. And so over the next 17 years, I did 34 turnarounds. So I loved doing it. It was like a renovation project, like restoring an old car. You bring it back to looking perfect, concourse condition. I was fairly ruthless. I didn't ask for other people's opinion. I came in, made my assessment, did the job that I was supposed to do, and was kind of fearless. And so that allowed me to do things very quickly and very effectively. And then in the last three companies, rather than taking fees, I took equity positions in those companies. And that allowed me to accumulate my first major capital that I owned. And then I bought my own manufacturing company and then built that up to a $40 million aerospace manufacturing company. And I arrived in America September 25th, 1973, with $300. I didn't finish high school. I was a little bit of a challenged student. And I built 12 companies since then, all multi-million and all highly profitable. So I've had a real fun career. I also developed a new software company 25 years ago. Now it's the world's largest quality software for aerospace, with over 8,000 companies using the software. And we were the very first software as a service platform in 1997. So we actually invented the genre. And so that has become immensely valuable, immensely successful. Every major aerospace company in the world uses the software. So it's an interesting. Then 2 years ago, I started another company, a fully automated robotic complex aerospace manufacturing. And we've just got a contract from SpaceX to do critical parts on their Starlink satellite. So I keep myself fairly busy. I do teaching. And the reason I wrote the book was because I was asked, a friend of mine bought a company about 3 years ago, and it was having trouble. And he asked me to come into it and help it. We got it profitable in a month. And suddenly I thought, all these principles that I've been following sort of instinctively, I need to write them down. Oh, I started writing the book, and I found a wonderful editor in New York and sent my wonderful manuscript to her. And she said, it's terrible. And over a period of a year, we edited it. And so the reason the end product is good was because of my wonderful editor in New York called Maria, who would keep on sending sections back saying, I think we can do a little better on this. And I'm not one that takes instruction very easily. So I accepted her advice. And originally it was 20 steps. And she said, that's way too many. It sounds exhausting. You need to narrow it down to 10. And you need to have a sort of a process and get some really good anecdotes in there to give it sort of credibility rather than just a theoretical manuscript about another how-to book.
Mm. Yeah, the anecdotes are great. So can we go back? We've just spanned the course of, well, I don't even know, from 67 to now, that's a lot of years. So you were 27 and you were doing the computers.
Yes.
Was that your own business?
Yes. So I found that there was a number of companies were buying their first computers and they were being ripped off by various intermediaries. So I set up a consulting firm where I do a turnkey and for a fixed price, and I would do all the installation, all the programming, all the teaching, all the training, and hand them the key, and the system would work.
And how did you know how to do that?
I've been in the computer business since 1967. That sort of knack of quickly learning how to do things. I don't know where it came from. I have a very good memory. I think solutions. I'm quite fearless. And I just, if I believe I can do something, I do it.
Wow. So you just said, okay, I'm going to create this company. And you did. And then you happened to be at the company whose financials you saw.
Yep.
And you happened to be invited to go to the bank. And the bank happened to say, hey, can you do this for us? So what happened to your computer company? Did you still run that, or did you?
I did a few, but the turnaround consulting was consuming pretty much all my time. And I really enjoyed that. I mean, the computer side, I enjoyed, but this was general business, really fun businesses that I got invited into. In fact, even one of the turnarounds was a large law firm in Seattle. And that was very interesting. That was not your law firms are basically a group of people who sort of agree to work together. There's no formal connection. It's sort of basic anarchy. And they just hope they'll stay together and share office space. But there's really no structural element of a law firm. They're just a group of people who agree to work together. So I had to have a come to Jesus meeting, explain who was making the money, who was not, and ranked all the lawyers on what they actually collected, not what they said they billed, and basically confronted them with their company, what their cash flow was, why the partners were taking advances on a monthly basis before they'd actually collected the money, and basically helped them grow up financially.
Wow. Now, okay, you had said you didn't graduate high school. I'm assuming you didn't go to college. How did you obviously, I mean, if you read the book, you'll see you know your stuff. You know stuff that people could never learn in school. You know, like somehow, like you said, you have the knack for knowing what's important, hitting it on the head, not being afraid to say it, you know, and getting rid of people who don't support you. I mean, it's just, you know, now maybe that book took a year, but to me, it was just like, wow, this is so, it's all right there. You know, what you need, what business owners need to come in with fresh eyes. I don't know if they can, you know, because you're coming in independent, so you have no skin in the game. I forget where I started with this. But anyway, so you just learned it. Like even with the law people, you know,
I didn't want to. One of my employees years ago said, you can see dead people. And I can see things that other people can't see. And I don't know why. It's just some analytical brain.
So that's just a gift.
Yes.
Just
absolute gift. And I'm also autodidactic. So I teach myself. But I only teach myself what I need to learn. I don't clutter it with stuff that I don't need to learn. So
I'm
very selective on what I choose to learn.
But how do you know what's important? Or you just do?
Common sense is not common. And very few people in Mark Twain said that, so I won't work at that for attribution. But common sense is very rare. And a pragmatic approach. We sort of dance around so many things. We're worried about people's feelings. We're worried about this. We're worried about that. And rather than pragmatically going for the jugular vein, as I point out to other turnaround people, I spoke to a CEO of a Canadian company, billion-dollar company, who's just been brought in to turn the company around. And I explained to him that, you know, you need to treat your company as if you were the emergency surgeon in a critical care unit. You don't worry about anything. Just focus on the mission, which is to keep the patient alive. Don't worry about the cosmetics. Don't worry about anything. Your job is to take someone who is seriously ill and potentially dying to save them. And that's kind of with a financial situation. It's the famous Hemingway quote that when a company asked how it went bankrupt, the person said, well, it was fairly slow to start with, and then it was all of a sudden. And that's how companies go bankrupt. They don't go on this sort of predictable glide path. They go along apparently just fine until one of their major suppliers stops shipping to them, and then they can't ship their product, and then the bank, they breach the bank covenants, and then the wheels fall off. So
like going back to the law firm, which I'm assuming was one of your early ones, but I'm not sure if that's true. Like, and you knew to go to hours billed, money collected. Yeah, cash. So that's where you turned that up. And then, so let's say, you know, I'm a lawyer and well, I don't know if you would tell me, but you got it. Let's say you have 10 lawyers, five of them are making money and the other five aren't. How do you do that? Just facts?
Facts go back to the accounting, go back to cash, what they actually received. And there were 40 lawyers. So I ranked them and from top to bottom. And I said, you may not want to know this, but this is what's happening. You're sharing overhead. And these are the people who are bringing in the money, and these are the people that haven't. So you either need to break up the law firm into smaller boutique law firms, or you're going to have a group of four or five that are carrying the entire firm.
And what did they do?
They broke up.
Wow.
And the top five spread off into an incredibly successful company, kept them at four or five, became, in the work that they did, they had a nationwide reputation. And they upped their fees and everything. The rest just were normal lawyers and lower overhead because they had smaller companies. But the collectively, it was never going to work.
Yeah.
So I think that's the, again, not to overuse the word pragmatism, but I can see when the emperor has no clothes.
And who had hired you? Who had brought you in?
They had borrowed from the bank. They had actually advanced their distributions on a monthly basis, and because they wanted to buy bigger houses, bigger cars, bigger yachts. And when they got to the end of the year, they had a massive bank debt because they hadn't collected the money that they borrowed. So it was very obvious. I mean, it was, as I point out to people, the real skills in turnaround should be completed in kindergarten. It's addition and subtraction. That's all it is. And when you get to a pragmatic level, you've either got the money or you haven't. And so I've been a forceful cash advocate. Unfortunately, what we teach accountants is to make things complicated and just make them better than they actually are. So if you have a CFO and your numbers are terrible, he'll come up with, or she'll come up with a way of saying, what if we accrue this and we distribute that, and we don't book this, and I can make the numbers look better. So they look to themselves as sort of financial magicians. And then by doing that, they make things unbelievably complicated. So only they understand. So the poor owner of the business now is completely bemused. And so what I do is I come in on day one and I bring everything back to a cash basis and confront the owner and the CFO. And say, from this point on, we're going to do it on a cash basis. All your deferrals, all your accruing, all your books that are booked, tax basis books, your tax to book, reconciliation, you've got a full-time job there and you don't need it. And most CFOs probably do 2 to 3 hours of work a week on almost any company these days, particularly with the accounting systems that are available. And one of the first questions I do is when I visit the CFO, what do you do every day? Mm-hmm. And then I spend the day with them. And almost invariably they say, well, this is just a quiet day. I said, no, it's not. It's always like this. And you need to find something else to do, because the CFO or accountant's job is something probably at most an hour a day, maybe 4 or 5 hours a week. And you've made it into a job by making it unnecessarily complicated, so only you understand. So now you've got to unravel it. So not to be negative on accountants, but the way they've been taught is they haven't been taught to be pragmatic. They've taught to contribution. They've been taught to create this island of knowledge where they're the one-eyed man in the land of the blind, or one-eyed woman in the land of the blind. And no one else knows. And then they go into, well, it's complicated. Well, of course it's complicated. You've made it complicated.
Right.
And so it's unraveling these pieces. And it's very, very quick to do it. And they get very angry. It's kind of like the I mentioned in the book, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and the stages people go through when they're dying. You know, first is denial, then anger, and then prayer, and then acceptance. And so once I reveal the process, they say it's not that bad. So they're in a stage of denial. And then when I pragmatically show it to them, then they say, well, then they get really angry. And who brought you in here? What authority do you have? And I said, I'm here basically to help you. And if you don't want help, I'll leave today. The bank will not be too impressed if I leave. So it was subtle leverage. I forced these companies to turn around. And I didn't give them any option. And I think that was the strength of being an independent person. But also, you know, I'm 6'3". I used to play rugby. As my wife says, I loom over people. I tend to just intimidate them by standing there. So in my early years, I used my looming.
I know in the book you say you could tell the people that weren't going to be around because they didn't want to work with you. Did any of these CFOs, I think you said some went running. They just left.
The second one just packed up his, he said basically the jig's up and packed up his bags and left. And luckily he had a really good accountant that reported to him. And when he understood there was a new sheriff in town, he read all the books. He went back to the bank to explain it was far worse than he thought it was, but this is what, these are the steps that we're going to take. And that was the second major one I did. I had nearly 500 employees. And I had to let go 280 in the first 2 weeks.
Wow.
So it can be, but you have to do it. I mean, you have to save the patient. Interesting enough, this was in 1975, and the company kept going and kept going. And after I turned it around, and 3 years ago, it was sold for $600 million.
And how many people did they have?
About 800.
Wow. So did they end up hiring those people back?
Some of them, yes. And when we let people go, we tell them it's like a football team. You know, we're only allowed a certain number of spots financially. We can only afford a certain number of people. It's not that you're bad. It's just that we can't afford it. And, you know, the company will turn around and there's a good chance you will be hired back. We only have a certain number of slots, what we can afford. And so I treat, you know, when people are let go, I let them know this was not failing on your behalf. This was a failing on the management of the company. And we don't have the funds to pay you. And I have to make hard decisions, and you're part of those hard decisions. One of the things I always encourage every CEO to do is to put in that right hand drawer of their desk a contingency plan. So if your business was cut in half for some reason, what steps would you take? Who'd you keep? What process would you go through to save the company? And I've always done it in every company I've owned. And so I was the aerospace manufacturing company. We were going along just fine. And the company was growing. I was very pleased with myself. The company was doing just great. And suddenly 9/11 hit, and our business dropped 45% in 3 months. We had more purchase order cancellations than I've ever seen. We had a whole department to manage purchase order cancellations and call our suppliers to cancel our POs. But I laid that all out in the plan, and I knew exactly which people I was going to keep, and we were profitable in 2022. So having a contingency plan is always a good idea. And because
2022, but 9/11 was 2001.
Yes, sorry, 2002. Sorry.
Wow.
The following year. We were one of the very few aerospace companies that was profitable the year after 2001. So it was just, so that's what I really encourage, plan for the worst and hope for the best.
So did you ever have any angry people that like got really mad? And
oh yeah, I had my car slashed. And I was one of the Teamster companies. They threatened to kill me, and I said, "Look, it's not going to do you any good. Kill me, someone else will come along." And so I just confronted people. I just said, "You know, you can't scare me. I'm going to say it as is." And people didn't threaten me. But again, being 6'3" and next rugby player, having been in the scrum, you don't intimidate very easily. I mean, that's a very, very brutal game. It's survival of the fittest. And you just have to survive. And you have to learn to be tough. And so I think that was, I'm not quite sure I could have done the job without being
so big. Yeah. Where did you play over before you came here?
Yes, I was played for one of the top clubs in London, and was actually a fairly good rugby player, except I had one person in front of me for all the national events, and he was so good. He was 6'6". He was actually an Olympic hurdler. His name was Andy Ripley, and I remember it to this day. He kept me out of every representative team.
Oh, and you couldn't switch teams?
Well, no, this was national, on a national basis. So the under 15s, under 18s, he kept me out of every single one.
Wow.
I couldn't get rid of him.
Wow.
So I was a B player to his A, but he was a once-in-a-lifetime player. So just unfortunate timing.
Mm-hmm.
I also was a discus thrower. And I held the British national record, junior record in the discus. I'm a fairly solid athlete.
Yeah.
I won the U.S. squash nationals in the U.S. when I was 54 in my division.
So why did you come to the U.S. with $300?
Two reasons. One, I was engaged to be married, and I decided that I needed to put some distance between us, which I had a sister living in Seattle. And I came to visit the summer before, and it was the most beautiful weather. It was 80 degrees out in the lake. So I sort of confused it a little bit with California. And so when I came, it wasn't quite the weather I expected. But there's some unique sort of resilience about America. England was going through self-doubt, a winter of discontent. The lights were going off. The miners were on strike, and I thought, I'm just not going to waste my life running up a down escalator. I need to go to it. Well, when I got to Seattle, unfortunately, in 1968, Boeing had let go 68,000 people out of 100,000. And so I didn't realize that the city was unbelievably depressed.
Mm.
I felt there was a spirit there. And I felt there was a degree of optimism, and it was kind of a phoenix from the ashes. And so we put a sign up on the way out from Seattle saying, "With the last person, leave, please switch the lights out." The estate agent put this big sign up. And the biggest problem were the U-Hauls, because they were only going in one direction. So they hired university students to drive them back for the next batch to leave. And so it was interesting. It was, by American standards, it was an absolute depression. By British standards, it was kind of middle of the road. But I felt this optimism the second I arrived. Americans have this unique can-do, and you just kind of feel it. And everything I tried to do, I had wonderful support. No one said, "You can't do that." When I built one of my companies, I had $400,000 in the bank, but I managed to persuade a bank to lend me $10.8 million. and just by the proposal and the vision.
Wow.
And that built the aerospace company. So it is, I think Americans, unfortunately, need to visit other countries and just spend some time there to understand how unique America is, how special it is, how exceptional it is. And it's everything I've built from that $300, probably close to $300 million, which is quite a large sum, I came from that $300.
Wow.
I have everything I want. I have everything that I could possibly need. Beautiful houses. I have a nice jet. I have just about everything. And I'm 77 and I still work 12 hours a day. So it's...
Well, I have a question. When you said you wanted to put distance, you were engaged and you wanted to put distance between who and who?
Between us, because whenever you break off an engagement, you're always the heel. And the person who gets their engagement broken off is always a sympathetic person.
Oh, I didn't know you broke it off. I thought yes. You got engaged.
No, I was engaged. There was a big wedding planned. Her father was fairly famous. And I decided probably putting 4,800 miles between us was probably the most effective way of
creating
a relationship.
And that's not your, you didn't marry her, right? You
no, I didn't.
Different wife. Okay. I didn't understand.
I've been married 46 years.
Yeah. Wow. So. Okay. I thought you had gotten engaged and you're putting distance. That didn't make any sense.
No, that was after the engagement. I was engaged and I put some distance between us.
Okay, good. All right. We're gonna take a break and hear from our sponsor, and then we'll be right back with more tales from the Art of the Turnaround author, Mike Dunlop. Thank you, Mike. We'll see you in a minute.
Great.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teacher's plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. Here's just something that I learned from Kikori's owner today. At Kikori, we believe that belonging isn't something you find, it's something you build. And when students feel safe, seen, and connected, they engage more deeply in learning, show up more consistently, and grow into who they are meant to be. So KikoriApp.com is all about what this show is doing for people, which is elevating and I forget the other word, elevating the consciousness of the planet, having people belong spreading joy, purpose, and passion. And if you want to bring Kokori to your schools, go to kokoriapp.com and schedule a demo, because it's really something that our children need and that they want and that it'll help them learn. So thank you again to our sponsor. And I'll keep my little commercial short, but if you want some inspiring reading, my memoir, Second Piece of French Toast, If Marriage Was My Dream, Why Was I Numbing Myself? If you find yourself numbing yourself and wondering what happened to your life, definitely check out my book. It will inspire you that you too can create a life you love, no matter how it looks now. Your Bullshit, Your Blessing is techniques I found along the way to get from the negative side of life to the fun side, so you can spend more time on the fun side. And then, as always, real talk, if you have trouble speaking up, which I did, as a people-pleasing, pleasant phony, everything was fine, but it wasn't. Speaking up changed my life as well. So you can go to realtalkwithhillary.com and check that out. And now we're going to bring back Mike Dunlop, who is a brilliant, brilliant turnaround artist. And I just want to say before I forget that, given the inauguration yesterday, I think you could turn around our government. I mean, I believe, this is my feeling, just my opinion, that you should be part of their team to do that, because you'll just cut through all the crap. And when I used to do consulting down in Washington, D.C., and the reason why I left was because they were spending millions of dollars automating these convoluted and complicated processes, you know, to, as you were saying, with the accountants, to keep their jobs. And they were wasting, in my opinion, millions. And I was like, why is this allowed to happen? I mean, I couldn't stand it. So I left, went back to New York, came back closer to home, and started working in the private center. But I was just like, you know, who but someone like you could go in and just, this is bullshit, you know? Bullshit. And so anyway, but I don't know.
The most interesting one is close by. So I have, Boeing is a very major customer of my software company. So I've sent a number of copies of the book to Kelly Ortberg and his team. And they're starting to follow the steps. And establishing leadership is obviously the first chapter in the book. But secondly, looking at Boeing's balance sheet, no one looked at Boeing's balance sheet for 15 years. And it went from $30 billion in cash in the bank to $60 billion in debt. Their inventory went from $8 million to $85 million. Their payables went from $1.6 billion to $10 billion while they stiffed all their suppliers. When I was working with Boeing, we got paid in 20 days. On the 19th day, I got notification that the money would be in my bank account the following day, and it was absolutely predictable. They're now 120 days.
Wow.
So all these poor suppliers who have had their price driven down, now they don't get paid on time. So one of my strong recommendations is Boeing borrow $9 billion and pay down their suppliers. Then their suppliers will do their work first rather than other people's, because they get paid first. And so one simple move will change how their suppliers respect them, rather than the financial cowboys that were in there before, where they had MBAs came in and said, look, all this money looking on the table, we can basically have the suppliers finance the Boeing company and get this free money. And instead, what they did was destroy their suppliers. And then the suppliers chose to do their work last rather than first, because they got paid last. So very, very simple changes. So I'm starting to see them be implemented and focus on the balance sheet. And
from your book?
From the book, yeah. Was how. So I probably am going to do for Washington State, finance a DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, not be part of the government, but part of the skill that Elon Musk and his team is going to have is one of the greatest motivators which is humiliation. And by showing what is happening to people's money and humiliating the people who waste it. And that's what he's going to be doing. And he has the perfect communication channel with X, and he's going to highlight it. He's going to, it'll be utterly pragmatic. He'll say, you know, this is this division wasted $400 million on this, and they need to be accountable. And so you're going to see with the new administration, very, very similar approach to the approach that I had with my turnarounds, which was if the emperor has no clothes, we will expose the emperor. And there'll be wholesale removal of all the people who have run interference or this, civil servants who have been spending money like a drunken sailor with a credit card. I mean, they have no
accountability.
No accountability. And we just borrow the money, spend whatever we want. Yeah. So the same is happening with Washington State. So I'm probably going to have, I can fund it easily, a group of people to analyze the Washington State budget and come up with recommendations, publish them, and say, this is where they're wasting money here. This is where they're wasting money on there. They were going to have electric ferries rather than diesel ferries because they're obsessed with, and someone pointed out that charging one of these ferries at night would be the equivalent electricity as a small town. And they were going to be three times as expensive as diesel. And they just waste money all over the place. And I think what the new administration is going to do is kind of what I did when I first went into companies, which is exposure.
Yeah.
You know, asking people what they do. One of the things I did with all the senior people in the company is require them to give me a personal profit and loss. And so I said, you cost me $200,000 a year. The company, hopefully in the future, will make 10%. So we've got to sell $2 million worth of product, manufacture it, sell it, and collect the money just to cover for your expenses. Now you tell me what you do every year to generate in excess of $2 million worth of business that we wouldn't have got if you weren't here. And if you can't do that, then I'll just make the choice and you won't be here, and I'll put that $200,000 direct to the bottom line, which is effectively the equivalent of 2 million sales at 10%. So I force people to...
And could any justify? Could any justify?
Virtually none. Virtually none. Now, people further down the level, the people on the shop floor, they would do $50,000 worth of value, and they would get paid $800 for the day. So their P&L was fantastic. It's just like a Boeing. I mean, there's 36,000 people on the shop floor at Boeing, and the percentage of their labor costs is only about 4% in a total airplane. And so every day they leave having left money in the company. All the people at the top have no justification for their compensation whatsoever. They're expensive overhead. So you have to remove them because you're asking the people at the bottom to carry the people at the top. And that's what I did very aggressively, was to remove multiple layers at the top and really compliment the people at the bottom, bring technology to the shop floor. I used to bring in one new piece in every manufacturing company. I bring in one new piece of equipment every month. And I would shut the plant down, and I'd explain to people why we had invested in it, what it was going to do, how it was going to help their future. And we did that every single month.
So where did you get the money for that if the companies were in trouble?
Borrowed it. I had great relationships with the machine tool suppliers, and almost always got zero down and just made monthly payments.
But it was worth the investment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was almost instantaneous. You bring it, if they haven't bought any new equipment for 25 years, the new equipment can do sort of 4x what the old equipment can do and do it perfectly every single time.
And it seems like, if I think about, you know, the book, and then my mind goes, whoa, there's so much to do. But it, you would go sequentially, right? You had a plan. You didn't get confused. You knew what you had to do, right? And it's in order. So someone doesn't have to get, they shouldn't skip around, right? They should.
It can be that there's some you can do at the same time. But normally the first thing is to, the first two are absolutely vital. And that's establishing leadership and finding out what the actual financial position is in the company. If you don't do those two first, you don't do the first one first, if you don't establish your leadership, then it's hard to do the others. If you don't establish the financial condition, it's hard to know what to do beyond that. So really, the first two are the are absolutely mandatory, with the first one definitely being first.
Now, if somebody, let's say I'm the owner and I'm going to take the book and do it. I mean, obviously I have leadership, but as you're saying, you need to change things, change your table, change all that, don't park, you know, all that stuff. But the second, I think some people, if they're not financial, and I know you stress this, this is not complicated. It's addition and subtraction, and you have to be willing to ask questions if they're making it too complicated to just get to the actual numbers.
Yes.
And but I would think that would, it would take almost stepping out of your skin if you were the one that allowed it to happen. Do you know what I mean? You really have to take on a new persona and a new.
Yes. Absolutely. And you have to do a mea culpa. You have to say, look, I didn't do it well before. And this time is, I'm the new sheriff in town, even though I'm the old sheriff. I'm going to be doing things differently. And I'm going to be listening more. And I'm going to take the trouble to watch the company financially rather than ignore it and hope things work out. And I can normally teach a CEO in an hour everything they need to know from a financial standpoint. That's maybe a little bit less than an hour, but once they have it explained, they go, that's incredibly simple. I say, yeah, but outside parties have an incentive to make it complicated, because then you have to pay them. And you have to pay them to interpret what you shouldn't have to interpret in the first place.
Well, so, it's like lawyers too.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the things that's going to change dramatically, and I've been working on not AI per se, but sort of pseudo AI, utilizing massive computer technology for about 15 years. And I kind of saw where this was going. So for the first time in human history, we have unlimited storage, unlimited computing power, and the ability to send information in real time to anybody in the world.
Right.
So you put that paradigm on top of any complexity, and suddenly it simplifies dramatically. And what you're going to find is the three professions that are going to be absolutely hammered by the new technology are going to be lawyers, accountants, and doctors. They're almost going to disappear as they are within 3 to 4 years.
Why I get lawyers and accountants, but why doctors?
Doctors, the human body has close to 32,000 illnesses that you can have. And there are a vast number of symptoms that need to be looked at, treatments, etc. The average doctor remembers 100, and the ones they see most frequently. So they will use it as a tool if they have a complex situation. Rather than sending them from tests and trying to, it's not this, it's not that, it's not this, it's not that. They'll basically feed the symptoms in, and they will get a complete analysis. You're almost going to have visual recognition of symptoms. So you'll take a picture of someone's face, and there will be stored people who have an illness that have a similar look about them. It's going to upend already MRIs, if they're fed into machine learning, have 100 times the capability of an individual. They can spot things on a granular basis that a human being can't even see. And so all these professions are going to be entirely disrupted. It's going to be phenomenal. It's going to be.
Well, what about, like, let's say you figure out the illness, but you have to treat it? Or is that still.
That's all there as well. Every treatment, every outcome is stored. What is the most successful? What is painful? What the side effects are? All done in 3 or 4 seconds.
All right. I have another question. Someone said that AI takes up more energy than anything. Is that true?
Yeah, it's the server farms do take a lot of energy, but we have a lot of energy. Both Gates and Bezos are inventing a small nuclear power system that is about the size of a refrigerator that will run the server farm forever.
Okay. So it's not an issue. I can let that one go.
Well, I think an exciting thing is Elon Musk is working on having server farms on satellites and using the sun to power them, which is when you're up in a satellite area, the sun's on permanently. And so building server farms, extraterrestrial server farms, so we won't even need them. And wow. I flew on a plane a couple of weeks ago that had the Starlink satellite connection. And within 2 years, you'll be able to download a full-length movie in less than a minute. So you will actually go on there with your iPad. So you on the airplane, you'll need none of the entertainment systems. You'll just go straight to the satellite, download the movie that you want. And if you don't have an iPad, they'll give you one. So the technology advancements, you know, I'm 77. I'm really, you know, I hope I live a little bit longer because... these are stunning, and it's exponential. And people have to understand what they're being taught today is virtually obsolete tomorrow. And things are changing so fast. So here they're worried about electricity for server farms, and here is Elon Musk and his team working on server farms that are powered by the sun on a permanent basis.
Wow. It's amazing.
It's a very exciting time.
Yeah.
That's what I try and teach university graduates, that they're living in the most golden of golden eras. We've never seen anything like this. We have no idea where it's going to go. We don't have no idea what the impact is. So quit worrying and enjoy the ride.
I love it. Thank you so much. Well, we have a couple minutes. I just want to get, you know, your vision, I think. I mean, your book is incredible. Again, if you don't have this, if you have a business, you owe it to yourself to read this, The Art of the Turnaround. It just makes it makes running a business so simple. And I think we've probably all complicated it a little bit. So what would be your vision? If 5-10 years from now, what do you hope that your efforts will bring about or the world you'd like to see?
I think taking away fear and giving people confidence that the water is warm. And don't worry. People are obsessively worrying. And I give the example, if I go for a company and I'm the CEO, acting CEO of a company, and I don't say good morning to someone, they immediately start to think, wow, if I did something wrong, am I going to be let go? If I get let go, I'll lose my aunt and I'll lose my car, I'll lose my... I'll be on the streets. And all I did was walk by and want to say good morning because I was thinking about something else. So I think the elimination of fear, it's a wonderful life and you need to quit worrying and wasting all that energy. So one quick anecdote with my students. At the beginning of the year, I asked them to get out a book and write for the first month everything that they're fearful of that they think is going to happen. Just write it now. And then at the end of the semester, I ask them to bring a book into class. And I say, we're going to have a test. And you've all failed 100%. And they said, why, Mr. Dunlop? I said, well, open up your book and put a tick on anything you were worried about that actually happened. And I said, I can tell you right from this point of view, you're zero. So look at all that energy, depression, being concerned. That never happened. He said to me, well, how did you deal with it? And I said, I'm a normal person. I'm not a sociopath. I worry like everybody else, but I only let it last 10 seconds. So I worry for 10 seconds, and then at the end of it, I say, it's not going to happen. Move on.
Wow.
So I actually truncate worrying. I think worrying is the most destructive and the greatest inhibitor for proper utilization of your life. And if you can manage that, then there really are no constraints for you in your life.
Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your genius, your brilliance, your...
I wouldn't go too far, but...
Enjoyment.
Yes. It's part of the book title. It's how to bring enjoyment and profitability. Not profitability and enjoyment. It's enjoyment and profitability.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Mike. I really enjoyed having you here. And thank you for all you do. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.